Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 599, update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on June 3rd of the year 2007. Now, due to the limitations of time, we're going to plunge directly into our reading of the paper that we began exploring on Side 1, a critical analysis of the collapse of World Trade Center Towers 1, 2, and 7 from an explosives and conventional demolition industry standpoint, written by Brent Blanchard on August 8th of 2006. Let's go right to the fundamental analysis. Now, the detailed analysis. Assertion number one, the towers' collapse look exactly like explosive demolitions, unquote. Protect comment, no, they didn't. It's the where, unquote. When discussing similarities between the tower's collapse and an explosive demolition, many people overlook the single question most central to any objective investigation. It is not how or when the buildings failed, but where they failed. That answer holds the key to understanding almost everything that occurred at Ground Zero. Since their inception in the late 1800s, blasting engineers have understood that building implosions work best when the forces of gravity are maximized. This is why blasters always concentrate their efforts on the lowest floors of a structure. While smaller supplemental charges can be placed on upper floors to facilitate breakage and maximize control as the structure collapses, every implosion ever performed has followed the basic model of obliterating structural supports on the bottom few floors first, quote, to get the structure moving, unquote. This was not the case with the collapse of Towers 1 and 2. Close examination of these events from every video and photographic angle available does not indicate failure originating from the lowest floors, rather clearly shows each building beginning to fail at precisely the point where the respective planes struck. That is, no floors above or below the impact points ever move until the structural elements within the impact zone begin to collapse. World Trade Center 7 collapsed differently, which we will cover later. Furthermore, there are no independent failures present while the structures are collapsing. We're not talking about dust plumes or debris, but actual structural failure. All lower floors remained completely intact until they were consumed by the collapse from above. Because countless images confirm this assessment and none contradict it, we believe this fact to be visually indisputable. Therefore, for explosives to be considered as a primary or supplemental catalyst, one would have to accept that either A, dozens of charges were placed on those exact impact floors in advance and survived the violent initial explosions and 1,100 plus degree Fahrenheit fires, or B, while the fires were burning, charges were installed undetected throughout the impact floors and wired together, ostensibly by people hiding in the buildings with boxes of explosives. There is no third choice that could adequately explain explosives causing failure at the exact impact points. The chemical properties of explosives and their reaction to heat render scenario A scientifically impossible and scenario B remarkably unlikely, as we know of no explosive compound that could withstand such force and/or heat without detaching from the columns or simply burning off prior to detonation. There are other problems with both scenarios. Given the consistent weight distribution around the outer perimeter of each structure, one would have needed access to a prohibitively large quantity of load-bearing I-beam columns to allow cutter charges to initiate failure. Those columns would have needed extensive preparation, also known as pre-burning, to allow the explosives to perform their function. And in order to prepare the columns, you first had to be able to see the columns, beginning again, and in order to prepare the columns, you first had to be able to see the columns, which means at least partially removing the outer perimeter interior walls of all blast floors, including furniture, plumbing, and conduit lines, insulation, etc. All of this would have been performed within the 55 minutes between the plane impact and collapse, working in an environment of unspeakable heat and destruction, or have been performed completely undetected in advance on multiple floors in both buildings while suffering no adverse effects from the plane's impact with these same areas. This is impossible. Assertion number two, but they fell straight down into their own footprint, unquote. Protect comment, they did not. They followed the path of least resistance, and there was a lot of resistance. Any discussion of how the towers fell on September 11th requires a fundamental understanding of how buildings collapse and an examination of the damage inflicted upon adjacent structures that morning. With very few exceptions, a tall office building, i.e. 20-plus stories, cannot be made to tip over like a tree. Reinforced concrete smokestacks and industrial towers can, due to their small footprint and inherently monolithic properties. However, because the supporting elements in a typical human-inhabited building are spread over a large area to accommodate living and workspace, they are not nearly as rigid, and the laws of gravity cause them to begin collapsing downward upon being weakened or tipped off center to a certain point. Blasters are well aware of this and often rely on this principle in designing upper floor charge patterns to maximize breakage and in predicting debris drop zones. The collapse of Towers 1 and 2 followed this principle exactly. When the impact floors of both towers eventually failed, the upper sections did not simply tumble over onto the street below, rather they tilted while simultaneously collapsing downward. One primary difference between these two collapses and a typical building implosion was that the initial failures occurred very high up on the structures, which lead to an extended duration, pancake-like effect down to the ground. With the weight and mass of the upper sections forcing the floor trusses below rapidly downward, there was no way for outer perimeter walls to fall in, so they had to fall out. A review of all photographic images clearly show about 95% of falling debris being forced away from the footprint of the structure, creating a giant mushroom effect around its perimeter. As we now know, significant amounts of heavy structural debris rained down for blocks around the site. Many of the closest World Trade Center buildings were completely destroyed and others heavily damaged. Predictably, the North Tower's collapse caused slightly more ancillary damage than the South Tower, as its impact point was higher, and thus a larger volume of debris was projected farther from its footprint. Video of the North Tower collapse clearly shows a roughly 50-story tall section of the building shearing away intact and laying out towards the west, heavily damaging the American Express building and others on the adjacent block. Aerial photos taken just after both collapses show massive volumes of debris that impacted World Trade Center 7 and other buildings to the north, the effects of which were directly responsible for the intense fires within that structure. These facts indicate that a relatively small amount of structural support debris actually landed straight down within the tower's footprints, making this event notably dissimilar to a planned demolition event. Assertion number 3. But explosive charges, aka plumes, squibs, etc., can clearly be seen shooting from several floors just prior to collapse, unquote. Protech comment. No. Air and debris can be seen pushing violently outward, which is a natural and predictable effect of rapid structural collapse. Human-inhabited buildings are typically comprised of about 70% air and 30% structural elements and contents. During any rapid collapse that air must be... Beginning again. During any rapid collapse, that air must be displaced in some manner. Therefore, when gravity makes a structure fall downward, the air within the structure is propelled horizontally through windows, door frames, or any other path of least resistance. In the case of World Trade Center 1 and 2, it has been scientifically documented that the failures of interior floor trusses were occurring slightly ahead of exterior columns, which is why the columns fell outward and contributed to a mushroom effect. Another side effect of this unequal progression was that air and various lightweight office contents was forced out of windows well below the visible collapse mechanism. The amount of debris seen jettisoning from any given floor or window was likely dependent on the condition of the windows, obstructions, or furniture blocking the windows, and the amount and weight of localized debris. The existence of vacant and non-occupied mechanical floors also likely affected the level or absence of expulsion in certain areas. Again, it is important to note that neither building structurally failed at any location where plumes were visible, nor did they fail at any point in advance of the single gravitational collapse sequence, which tells us that the plume phenomenon witnessed was a predictable effect that gravity dictates had to occur. Assertion number four. Several credible eyewitnesses are adamant that they heard explosions in or near the towers, unquote. Protech comment. Maybe they did hear loud noises that sounded to them like explosions, but such statements do nothing to refute scientific evidence that explosives were not used. Arguing over who heard explosion-like noises, when they heard them, how loud they were, or from what direction they came is a pointless exercise. This is not to imply that any witness should be ridiculed or dismissed. However, such subjective, highly interpretive statements do nothing to prove or disprove the presence of explosives. Simply put, there are countless causes of sharp, loud noises that have no relation to explosives. The only scientifically legitimate way to ascertain if explosives were used is to cross-reference the fundamental characteristics of an explosive detonation with independent ground vibration data recorded near ground zero on September 11th. Fortunately, several seismographs were recording ground vibration that morning, and perhaps more fortunately, all available data is consistent and appears to paint a clear picture. Seismographs at Columbia University's Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory in Palisades, New York, recorded the collapses of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. This data was later released to the public and currently appears on their website. Additionally, on September 11th, Protech field technicians were utilizing portable field seismographs to continuously record ground vibrations on several construction sites in Manhattan and Brooklyn for liability purposes. In all cases where seismographs detected the collapses, waveform readings indicate a single, gradually ascending and descending level of ground vibration during the event. At no point during September 11th were sudden or independent vibration spikes documented by any seismograph, and we are unaware of any entity possessing such data. This evidence makes a compelling argument against explosive demolition. The laws of physics dictate that any detonation powerful enough to defeat steel columns would have transferred excess energy through those same columns into the ground, and would certainly have been detected by at least one of the monitors that were sensitive enough to record the structural collapses. However, a detailed analysis of all available data reveals no presence of any unusual or abnormal vibration events. Assertion number five. An explosive other than conventional dynamite or RDX was used, a non-detonating compound such as thermite, aka thermate, which gets very hot upon initiation and can basically melt steel. This can be proven by photographs of molten steel taken at ground zero, the temperature and duration of underground fires, and comments made by rescue workers, unquote. Protech comment, we have come across no evidence to support this claim. This claim is actually a loose connection of unrelated individual assertions, therefore we must address them as such. 1. The vast majority of comments made by rescue workers, city officials, or various others not involved in the actual demolition process at Ground Zero regarding the heat of underground fires or molten anything, unquote, steel, aluminum, tin, composites, etc., are conjecture and have no practical value in determining what types of materials were actually burning and at what temperature. Most were simply never in a position to know, and those that were have acknowledged that they don't know for sure. 2. Photographs that we have examined purporting to show demolition equipment extracting molten steel, unquote, from the debris at Ground Zero are inconclusive at best, and most are inaccurate as described. Extracting various hot metallic compounds or debris is one thing, but molten steel beams, unquote, is quite another. As a fundamental point, if an excavator or grapple ever dug into a pile of molten steel heated to excess of 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, it would completely lose its ability to function. At a minimum, the hydraulics would immediately fail and its moving parts would bond together or seize up. The heat would then quickly transfer through the steel components of the excavator and there would be concern for the safety of its operator. The photos we have reviewed on various websites do not show any of this, and if anything indicate that the underground fires, while very hot, were not hot enough to melt steel. 3. In an effort to further research this assertion, we spoke directly with equipment operators and site foremen who personally extracted beams and debris from Ground Zero, several of whom have requested anonymity to prevent harassment. These men worked for independent companies in separate quadrants of the site, and many were chosen due to their extensive experience with debris removal following explosive demolition events. To a man, they do not recall encountering molten structural steel beams, nor do they recall seeing any evidence of pre-cutting or explosive severance of beams at any point during debris removal activities. The assertion that thermite played a role in the tower's collapse has been put forth by Stephen Jones, a professor at Brigham Young University. This author spoke with Professor Jones at length in February of 2006, and we have corresponded via email a few times since. As he has explained it, metallurgic tests were conducted on two sections of steel beams that were saved for September 11th memorials in the New York area. These beams apparently tested positive for, quote, trace amounts of thermite, unquote, which led Jones to conclude that thermite was used on September 11th by unknown parties to compromise support beams in World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. Professor Jones acknowledges that his investigation is still in the research phase and that questions regarding the viability of his theory remain unanswered. For example, it is unknown how thermite's destructive process could have been applied and initiated simultaneously on so many beams in several buildings undetected and/or under such extreme conditions. It is also unusual that no demolition personnel at any level noticed telltale signs of thermite's degenerative footprint, unquote, on any beams during the 8 months of debris removal, and a verifiable chain of possession needs to be established for the tested beams. Could they have been cut away from the debris pile with acetylene torches, shears, or other potentially contaminated equipment while on site? Could they have been exposed to trace amounts of thermite or other compounds while being handled or in storage or during the transfer processes from Ground Zero to the memorial sites? We do not know the answers, but these and many related questions should be addressed if this assertion continues to be pursued. Assertion number 6. Debris removed from Ground Zero, particularly the large steel columns from Towers 1 and 2, were quickly shipped overseas to prevent independent examination or scrutiny. Protec comment, not according to those who handled the steel. The large steel support members extracted from Ground Zero were handled differently than other debris, mostly because of their size and quantity. This type of initial separation increases job site efficiency and is not unusual on demolition projects. Once the steel was extracted and or cut away from other debris, it was piled in staging areas just outside the work zone. These piles were then loaded onto trucks that transported them a few blocks north to a secondary staging area on the Hudson River. Cranes transferred the steel from the trucks onto barges, which were shipped to Fresh Kills Landfill in Staten Island. At this point, it transferred into the control of Yanutsi Demolition, whose team was responsible for offloading the barges and storing the steel in an area separate from general debris arriving on other barges. It was then examined and cataloged by a series of forensic investigators, city officials, and site managers. Sometime later, the timing varied due to logistical factors, the steel was shipped off-site to China. Our research team can personally verify the lower Manhattan chain of possession as we witnessed and documented this chain. We then reviewed activities that occurred at Fresh Kills by speaking with John Yanutsi, president of Yanutsi Demolition. Our team also reviewed commentary made by Dennis Dannenfeltzer, Yanutsi's Fresh Kills site supervisor, who oversaw the entire operation from start to finish and spoke candidly and extensively at the National Demolition Assertions annual convention in March of 2003. According to all parties, the steel went through the same series of steps as it would have on any other demolition project, albeit on a larger scale and with an increased presence of examiners. No one we spoke with perceived an attempt to rush or hide the process, and to the opposite, dozens if not hundreds of unrelated individuals working for various entities and possessing various types of expertise came in close contact with the steel over a period of months before it was eventually shipped overseas. In consideration of these first-hand experiences and interviews, and absent any dissenting commentary, we can find nothing to support this assertion. Assertion number 7. World Trade Center 7 was intentionally pulled down with explosives. No airplane hit it, and the building owner himself was quoted as saying he made a decision to pull it, unquote. Protech comment. This scenario is extremely unlikely for many reasons. The above assertion has taken several forms over the past few years and has developed into a major point of discussion among conspiracy theorists. Most recently, it was used as a cornerstone allegation on C-SPAN's national broadcast of a September 11th symposium hosted by Mr. Alex Jones, an author and radio personality who was highly critical of the government's handling of September 11th. However, from a demolition standpoint, several aspects of this claim are problematic. One, a building owner would never be in a position to dictate to fire personnel or emergency workers whether his building should be pulled or demolished. We know of no case where command and control of a disaster scene has ever been transferred to a private third party, much less a disaster of such scope. This action would violate a number of ethical canons regarding the safety of emergency responders and the general public, not to mention exposing those who transferred and assumed such authority to substantial liability risks. Therefore, even if such a statement was made on September 11th, it is highly doubtful that the comment would have affected the decisions at the scene. 2. We have never, ever heard the term pull it being used to refer to the explosive demolition of a building. Neither has any blast team we've spoken with. The term is used in conventional demolition circles to describe the specific activity of attaching long cables to a pre-weakened building and maneuvering heavy equipment, excavators, bulldozers, etc., to pull the frame of the structure over onto its side for further dismantlement. This author and our research team were on site when workers pulled over the six-story remains of World Trade Center 6 in the late fall of 2001. However, we can say with certainty that a similar operation would have been logistically impossible at Ground Zero on September 11th, physically impossible for a building the size of World Trade Center 7, and the structure did not collapse in that manner anyway. Any detonation of explosives within World Trade Center 7 would likely have been detected by seismographs monitoring ground vibration in the general area. To our knowledge, no such telltale spike or vibratory anomaly was recorded by any monitoring instrument. See assertion number 4. Saying no airplane hit it implies the structure suffered minimal effects from the planes crashing into the adjacent towers. In fact, nothing could be farther from the truth. Video and photographs of the North Tower collapse clearly depict substantial upper sections of the building falling outward and impacting World Trade Center Buildings 6 and 7. This was not a glancing blow from extraneous material, rather thousands of tons of steel girders falling directly onto the building from hundreds of feet above. World Trade Center 7 sustained significant impact damage to its southwest corner up to the 18th to 20th floor, or a little less than halfway up the building. There was also significant damage to the building's south face, although dense smoke present in most photos hinders an exact assessment. Other photos depict several lower floors fully involved in a large fire that either began upon impact or shortly thereafter, and most experts point to the large stockpile of diesel fuel stored in the basement as the likely catalyst. Regardless of the fire's origin, these flames are clearly visible from all four sides of the structure. With most local firefighting equipment destroyed and the search for survivors being of primary concern, these intense fires were left to burn uncontrolled for more than 6 hours, further compromising the already badly damaged structure. Given these facts, any implication that World Trade Center 7 was not substantially affected by the original plane crashes is not accurate. 5. Several demolition teams had reached Ground Zero by 3 p.m. on September 11th, and these individuals witnessed the collapse of World Trade Center 7 from within a few hundred feet of the event. We have spoken with several who possess extensive experience in explosive demolition, and all reported hearing or seeing nothing to indicate an explosive detonation precipitating the collapse. As one eyewitness told us, quote, "We were all standing around helpless. We knew full well it was going to collapse. Everyone there knew. You got to remember there was a lot of confusion and we didn't know if another plane was coming, but I never heard explosions like demo charges. We knew with the damage to the building and how hot the fire was that the building was going to go, so we just waited, and a little later, it went. 6. Finally, we have not discovered or been presented with any physical evidence indicating explosives were used to fell the structure. We do not know exactly how or why World Trade Center 7 fell when it did, and we decline to hypothesize here. All we can offer is that from a demolition and structural failure standpoint, available data does not rule out the possibility of the building collapsing as a direct result of the structural conditions detailed above. Assertion number 8. A steel-framed building has never collapsed due to fire, yet 3 steel buildings collapsed on one day, therefore explosives must have been responsible, unquote. Protech comment. No. Actually, it means 3 steel buildings collapsed due to fire and violent external forces on one day. Many unprecedented things happened on September 11th. To draw any specific relationship between how many buildings were destroyed and the reason for their collapse runs counter to logic and common sense. The fact is, many steel structures have collapsed due to fire, and as with those failures, the collapse of all 3 buildings on September 11th involved specific structural conditions. Each failure displayed characteristics dissimilar to the other 2, and in no case have we come across evidence of explosives being present or affecting any of those conditions. Assertion number 9. Anyone denying that explosives were used is intentionally ignoring or dismissing evidence that doesn't suit their conclusion, unquote. Protech comment. Please. If anyone knows of specific physical evidence relating to explosives being used in any manner on the Ground Zero site, bring it to our attention. As you have noticed, most of our comments relate to the differences between what people actually saw on September 11th and what they would have seen had explosives been present. Absent any evidence of explosives use, that is all we can offer. Well, that and noting how no evidence has surfaced during 5 years of furious independent web investigations and intense media hubbub. It also bears repeating that the men and women who actually deconstructed and removed the debris from Ground Zero were not part of a clandestine cartel of government stooges working to obstruct justice. Rather, this collection of several hundred workers represented some of the country's most experienced and highly respected demolition veterans. Recall the impressive fact that no one was killed during the cleanup. Most quickly became consumed by the project and worked on site from the first day to the last, stressing marriages and families to the breaking point. But their consistent presence, combined with their vast collection of past experiences working on explosive demolition projects, made them precisely the group of people who would have been most likely to spot and call attention to abnormalities in the debris, had there been any. With all due respect to distinguished scholars and others alike, it matters little whether Alex Jones is drawing parallels to building implosions, Stephen Jones is drawing conclusions from hot metal, or Chuck Jones is drawing dynamite in the hands of Wile E. Coyote. For assertions to be credible, they must eventually comply with the scientific principles of explosive initiation and of structural failure, realistic judgments of probability, and indisputable visual evidence. Thus far, every assertion we have investigated scores a resounding 0-3. Our team welcomes the opportunity to review additional data as it becomes available. However, barring any additional evidence, those making allegations similar to the points above may do well to consider that sometimes asking tough questions, unquote, isn't the biggest challenge. It's accepting the answers and decisively moving on to other areas that render their contributions productive and valuable. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program number 599, update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on June 3rd of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.